88. Nola had pulled the trigger. Royal froze. He looked down at himself, patting his chest. There was the old blood from the wound in his shoulder. But other than that, he started to laugh.
You dumb shitard! You missed! He hissed.
He looked up like he was about to take off.
Don't. Not a step, Nola warned,
her voice not nearly as strong as usual. The color was wiped from her face. To crawl all the way here, she lost so much blood. She was down on her stomach, her hands quaking. But no way was she letting him go free. 50 feet away, halfway down the aisle, Royal stood there, catching his breath and eyeing her like prey. The only thing between them was the shallow puddle of embalming fluid, the skylight reflecting off it, adding an odd serenity to the dark warehouse.
Nola, if you think you have the balls to pull the trigger, pop.
Nola fired again. There was a ping and a spark. The bullet ricocheted off something in the distance.
Another miss? Royal asked,
a thin grin lifting his cheeks.
That's gonna cost you your life.
If he wanted, he could have darted to his right, back toward the halogen lamps, and cut over to the aisle that ran parallel to this one. Escape. Instead, he stood his ground, readjusting the metal trocar in his hand. Behind him, Zig was slumped across the concrete, unmoving. Nola wanted to pull the trigger again, but the way her vision was darkening, the way the world was tilting, she'd lost so much blood. She wanted to get up, wanted to put her hands around his throat, but right now she couldn't feel anything below her waist. And no matter how hard she tried, she still couldn't stop her hands from shaking.
Always such a stubborn bitch, aren't you, Nola? I can see the pain in your face. You can't even see straight, can you?
Nola stayed silent, refusing to tell him there were three royals staring back at her.
Aim for the one in the middle.
But every time she lifted her head, she felt woozy, like she was on a life raft and the room was bobbing. Her heart raced, fighting to compensate for the blood loss. If she fired again, he was too far. Wouldn't be a direct hit. Still, Nola held tight to the trigger, her eyes struggling to stay on the man who buried her all those years ago.
Come on, Nola, take your shot. I'll give you a free one,
Royal said, sticking his chest out, spreading his arms wide like he was up on the crucifix. A thin line of mucus ran from Nola's nose. She fought to keep her head up. The gun felt like an anvil in her hands.
No? That's it?
You give up?
Royal asked, lowering his arms, still holding the metal trocar. He gave a quick glance behind himself to make sure Zig was still out. Unconscious.
That's the part I want you to remember, Nola. In the end, despite all your pushy interference, when you finally got to the finish line, you're the one who surrendered. Like always, you gave up, never able to finish the job. The same lazy nigger you've always been.
Nola began, though the words wouldn't come. Her head bobbed low again, but she could still see Royal, could see that satisfied smile on his face. He was having fun now, especially as he took his first step toward Nola. He choked up on the trocar. Then his foot made a small splash as his heel hit the puddle of embalming fluid. Now Nola was the one grinning. Royal could have avoided the puddle, could have walked the long way around to make sure he didn't come into contact with the flammable fluid. But that was Royal's flaw. It had always been his flaw. Ever since he took her home as a child, Nola knew she was the one who was Royal's greatest weakness. Nola tipped her gun forward, aiming it diagonally toward the ground, straight at the puddle of fluid. Even now, with her head bobbing, it was the one shot even she couldn't miss. Royal froze. His eyes became saucers.
Nola, don't!
too late. Nola's finger curved around the trigger. Royal tried running. He looked terrified, then enraged, then terrified again, all in the span of half a second as the two of them shared a long, final glance. The angle they were at, him looking down on her like he was standing at the door of her bedroom. It was as if Nola was 7 years old, and he was her dad, and he'd just brought her home on that first night, tucked her into bed, and all might be well in the world, even though young Nola, even back then, knew it wouldn't be. She wanted to say something vengeful, wanted to tell him how long she'd waited for this moment, wanted to tell him how much pain he was about to be in, and of course how much he deserved every bit of it. Instead, she pierced him with a dark glare, staring unflinchingly into Royal's now wide eyes.
Nola,
he pleaded, his voice cracking. She squeezed the trigger. Pop. There was a spark as the bullet hit the embalming fluid, then a deafening whoosh, like a gas main being lit. Royal was still in mid-run, frozen with one foot in mid-air, as a thick column of fire rose from the puddle, swallowing him whole.
Nah!
Royal screamed, his clothes, his hair, his face, all of it engulfed in bright blue flame. Nola knew what was coming next. Down on the ground, she tucked herself into a ball, covered her head, and turned away from the puddle. Within seconds, the fire spread across the top of the puddle, snaking its way back to the original metal drum of embalming fluid. Nola counted to herself. 3, 2. There was an ear-splitting roar, a thunderclap 2 aisles away, as a massive explosion sent a black and orange fireball mushrooming to the roof. The warehouse rattled and shook. It felt like a mortar hit, the metal drum taking off like a bottle rocket, zigzagging toward the front of the warehouse. The onslaught of heat came so fast, even 2 aisles away, Nola thought her back was burned. By the time the heat receded and she finally looked up, Royal was on the ground, thrashing frantically, rolling back and forth as he tried to put the flames out.
Please! Someone! My eyes! It's in my eyes! Nola! Please!
Nola didn't move. Royal kept rolling, twisting along the concrete. Behind him, the puddle was still burning at knee height. Then he was just lying there, a black, charcoaled brick, flat on his back and barely moving as steam rose off him. 12 seconds. That's all it took. The skin on Royal's face bubbled and boiled. Parts of his hands were bright white, other parts were black and charred. His chin took it worst, a mess of bloodied, melted blisters. Plus there was that smell of burnt hair and skin. Still on his back, Royal was moaning, making a noise like a kicked dog. He was alive, though. No longer a threat, but alive. Nola's reaction was instantaneous.
Gah,
she grunted, army crawling on her elbows, straight toward Royal, her hand still shaking as she pointed her gun at his head. Time to finish the job. On her left, all the bookcases were on fire. Some furniture, too. Small campfires burned all around her from the rusted drum's explosion, but since the warehouse was filled with mostly porcelain and metal, she wasn't worried the place would go up in flames. Even if it did, she wasn't sure she cared. A few feet away, Royal's chest rose and fell. He was still breathing. Not for long.
Nola! Don't do it!
A familiar voice called out. She looked to her right. On the opposite side of the burning puddle, Zig was awake, curled on his side, his face a purple mess from Royal's beating with the trocar.
Stop talking, she thought to herself, crawling forward on her belly, her arm outstretched, the barrel of her gun getting closer to Royal's head.
Nola, don't let him turn you into a killer,
Zig added.
It's over. He's done. He'll pay for his crimes.
No, He won't, Nola thought, throwing her elbow forward with a grunt. He'd escape again, take on another new name, disappear into yet another new life. It was his specialty. The room was still swaying and bobbing. Her breathing was heavier than ever. She was a fool to keep moving. But as she stared at the rise and fall of Royal's chest, for this piece of shit, she didn't mind being a fool.
Nola, listen to me, Zig begged. Those people on that plane, that woman, Camille, she wouldn't want you to do this.
This isn't for them, Nola thought. It's for me. She was less than 2 feet away. Almost there. Her outstretched arm was quivering so much, she put the butt of the gun on the ground, pressing it down into the floor just to keep it steady.
It'll haunt you forever, Nola. Whatever pain he caused you, Zig added. When you take someone's life, you can't take that back.
Nola pressed the gun against Royal's head. Wisps of his burnt, smoke-colored hair curled around the barrel. It reminded her of a painting. She wanted to do a painting of this moment, of the shiny barrel against his charred skin. She was memorizing details, saving them for later as her finger slowly slid around the trigger. She gripped it tight.
Pull,
she told herself.
Just pull.
But she didn't. There was a crackle and a loud pop a few aisles away. The fire consumed yet another lost piece of military history. In the distance outside, she could hear the faint sound of an approaching siren. Fire alarm must have gone off. Help would be here soon. Nola let go of the gun, which clattered to the floor.
Nola, you made the right choice, Zig said,
still lying there on the opposite side of the low-burning puddle. In front of her, Royal's body twitched like he was lost in a dream, or when she used to sneak past his room, praying he wouldn't wake up when he was drunk on Tuesday and Saturday nights. At that, she remembered their old car and how it smelled of cigarettes and Armorall on those nights when she'd sleep in the back seat. She remembered the burnt steaks, the screaming, the shoveling and all the dirt. Dooch, the skunk. And of course, that first night, being dragged from the LaPointes. Most of all, she remembered the promise she made to herself all those years ago. If she ever saw him again, the promise that brought her here today. In one quick movement, Nola grabbed the gun, pointed it at Royal's head, and pressed it to his temple.
Nola, no!
Pop. A burst of blood sprayed across the concrete. Hunks of Royal's skull scattering in every direction. Finally, promise kept. Zig was yelling something louder than ever. Nola didn't hear it. The room was bobbing up and down uncontrollably now, the world again shrinking around the edges. Her heartbeat was deafening, pounding and thumping in her temples, in her fingertips, in her tongue, blood still pouring from behind her twisted knee.
I just need to put my head down,
Nola said, though her lips never moved.
Just a little rest. A little nap. Right here,
she added. Then she did just that. As half a dozen fractured fires continued to burn around her, Nola put her head down on an overstuffed, fluffy pillow, not even realizing it was the cold, hard concrete. 89. Nola woke up after the surgery. It was a full day later, the following morning. Though the way a wave of nausea pulled from the inside of her throat, it seemed like it had been a week. All at once, she heard the beeps and boops, the chorus of droids, from the half a dozen electronic monitors she was hooked up to. A TV on the opposite wall was already on, with an old episode of Family Feud.
Welcome back, sleepyhead, said a black nurse with a wide, oval face and crooked teeth.
She was standing at the far side of the bed, checking the dorsalis pedis pulse in Nola's foot. The nurse asked a question. Nola barely heard it. On Nola's right, a beige recliner was pulled close to the bed, like someone had been visiting. On her left was a dry erase board with the logo for Kent General Hospital, Delaware. She was still in Delaware. The board also had Nola's name, blood type, birth date, and an emergency contact with a number Nola didn't recognize. 202 area code, Washington, D.C. She read the number three times, unable to place it. Her brain wasn't working right. That tug in her throat. She was dizzy again, nauseous.
"Here, if you need to throw up,"
the nurse said, placing a plastic yellow bedpan on Nola's chest.
"Our barf bags don't hold squat."
Nola nodded like it all made sense. Her right leg was immobilized, numb, wrapped in gauze. Surgery. She'd been through surgery. That explained the nausea. The drugs. Yet what Nola noticed more than anything else, outside, in the hallway, there was a man. Tall forehead, thick neck, military build, skin the color of bronze. He was in full military dress, standing guard. Single silver bar on his shoulder board. First lieutenant. Not a soldier. An officer. He looked over at Nola, not saying a word. It made no sense, Nola thought. But the world was again being squeezed at the edges, the room tilting and starting to spin. Why would they send an officer?
90. Where's his body?
Still at Dover, Master Guns said. They're not transferring him to Torbert's? Sig asked, referring to the local funeral home where Dover sends most civilians. Master Guns made a noise, like a grunt. You want the bad news or the bad news?
Like I have a choice?
Climbing out of his hospital bed, Zig headed for the bathroom in the corner, lifted his medical gown, and took a long, frightfully satisfying piss. As he washed his hands, he caught his own reflection in the mirror.
Don't look in the mirror, Master Guns called out.
I'm not, Zig said, staring straight at himself. Busted lip, two black eyes, a severe orbital rim fracture, 14 stitches between his forehead and chin, plus a ruthless dark bruise that turned his cheekbone into a purple pillow. Zig had seen worse. This would heal. Or at the very least, could be covered up.
Give me the bad news first.
I spoke to Dino's sister, Master Guns said. She's devastated, of course. Making flight arrangements now. She should be here by tomorrow. Heading back to the hospital bed, Zig picked at the cast on his broken arm and took a long look at his friend. Standing at the center of the room, posture forever perfect, Master Guns was silent.
Tell me what you're not saying, Zig added.
Listen. When you say listen, I'm already listening.
What else did she say?
Nothing. She just... For Dino's funeral, he cleared his throat. She requested that you be the one to work on his body. Asked for you by name.
Zig nodded.
He expected as much. When Zig was little, Dino's sister used to drive them to high school. Bought beer and wine coolers for him and Dino, too.
Ziggy, you don't have to
tell her I'll do it. I can make an excuse. Let her know you're in the hospital.
Stop. I'm doing it, Zig said, reaching for the red and white duffel that Master Guns brought from Zig's home.
Zig pulled out a pair of old jeans, quickly climbing into them.
Ziggy, what are you? You said his sister will be here tomorrow. If I don't start now, are you a moron? Your doctors, they said they want you under observation for at least another day. Your concussion, I'm fine. You're not fine. And if you think I'm letting you back in the mortuary, you said Dino took a bullet to the head. That's where Royal shot him, right? You think you got enough pieces of his skull to put him back together?
Master Guns didn't respond. Dino's family is Catholic. I helped bury their mom. Their dad, too. His sister Denise, she'll want an open casket. Do you even have an intact face? Or is that gonna need major sculpting and a rebuild, too?
Ziggy. You think we're having a discussion. We're not, Zig shot back. When Denise gets here tomorrow, she's expecting an open casket. I'm giving her an open casket. Okay? I'm doing it. Fallen number 2358. I need to do it, Zig said, buttoning his jeans. As he pulled a fresh shirt over his head, a Rorschach blot of blood seeped from his forehead into the chest of his t-shirt. You're one stubborn pain in my ass, you know that? Master Gunn said. You really thought I'd sit here in a hospital and let you give his case to Will? Master Guns nodded at the mention of Zig's fellow mortician. He's definitely a bigger a-hole than you are, Ziggy. Plus, I hate the way he spells his name with one L. Douchebaggery. Zig went to smile, but the tug on his skin from the stitches hurt too much. Still, if Master Guns was making jokes, he was prepping Zig for another bomb. If it makes you feel better, Master Guns added, we've been tearing through Dino's records. Phone, email, all of it. His financials were... Master Guns paused, taking a big breath through his nose. Ziggy, he had some pretty bad debts. How bad? Really bad. As in, taking money from his own grandmother bad. Whatever his goal was, he was flailing. His debt was well into six figures, and from what we can tell, if he didn't pay soon, someone would have dropped by his house and offered him the claw side of a hammer. That doesn't excuse it. Not saying it does. But whatever Dino did, whatever money he was taking from Royal to pay back his debt, I don't think for one second Dino was purposely trying to hurt you. Zig stayed silent, pulling out a pair of socks and taking a seat on the side of the hospital bed. What about his sister? What are you telling her? You think I have any say there? This is coming from the top. The real top. 456 number, Master Guns said, referring to the prefix for the White House. Did I tell you the president called me? You told me. Tell me about Dino. If I was a wagering man, and I'm always a wagering man, I'm guessing they'll be using words like innocent bystander. They'll tell her that Dino was doing his job, stocking Reese's pieces in the candy machine when suddenly he was shot by Royal. Poor Dino being just another victim in the wrong place at the wrong time. Zig acted surprised, but he wasn't. At Dover, he saw it every day, the government choosing to tell a half-truth to ensure that a military secret stayed secret. In this case, what Royal did, finding out about a paying agent who was skimming money, and then the two of them using that info to plan their own super heist, it had put Operation Blue Book on the front page of every newspaper. Even worse, it would risk exposing the identities of every current and previous soldier who worked undercover for it. The president loves the program. Apparently he's a Harry Houdini fan, too. He was hoping to protect Blue Book at all costs. That's why, when the plane crash first happened, they rushed everyone so quickly through Dover. Keep it hush-hush and keep the program intact. The body that they thought was Nola's just got swept up in that. No one would have raised an eyebrow. Until, of course, you realized it wasn't her. And that's also why he put one of his oldest friends, the Librarian of Congress, in charge of Blue Book to begin with. Unlike our generals, when the librarian is flying somewhere, no one looks twice at who's sitting there next to him. So Rookstuhl was doing real work in Alaska? Real work. He was the point man all the so-called students reported to. It's been like that for decades. He was flying back with three of them, since they never liked putting them all on the same plane. Apparently, Harry Houdini donated his books to the Library of Congress for a reason. Who knew librarians could be so dangerous? Zig was still silent, sliding each foot into a sock, then into his shoes. Today, the government was hiding soldiers on college campuses, in computer science training programs, so we can track potential hackers and terrorists. Tomorrow, we'd have different problems. We'd hide them somewhere else. But there would always be a need for Harry Houdini's Blue Book and the covert corps that went with it. You know, for a while, Sig said, when we were looking for who was behind it all, I was worried it might be you.
Yeah, well, I forgive you, Master Gunn said, forcing a laugh. President Wallace thought the same.
Then I thought for sure it was Sue. She was the last person I saw on that day the president came to see the bodies, right before I got smashed in the head and knocked unconscious.
Master Guns went silent, both of them replaying that morning in the mortuary, populating it with Dino instead of Colonel Sue. She was investigating just like they were, and was the only one smart enough to be suspicious of Dino. She even questioned him in her office.
So Sue has heart, huh? Sig asked.
I have to say, I thought she was no heart. But after this, heart.
Sig thought about that. I hate being wrong.
Frickin' A. Crumpling up his hospital gown into a small, compact ball, Sig gripped it tight, like he was trying to keep it from expanding. You know, Ziggy, there's just one little detail that still makes no sense to me, Master Gunn said, glancing over at the TV on the wall and pretending to watch, even though it wasn't on. When you snuck back into Dover and got on that plane to Alaska, I talked to the pilots. They said that the plane had pretty much taken off, but you threw a holy fit, convincing them to stop right there on the runway.
I told you.
You realized Nola pulled another fast one and wasn't in the coffin. I remember. I've heard you tell this story 3 times now. You're lucky the pilots listened to you. Nola might have been dead if they didn't.
Master Guns was still eyeing the blank TV, admiring it.
But what I still can't figure out, Ziggy, is... Well, when you got off that plane, you went running straight to the graveyard, he said, referring to the old warehouse. Straight to where Nola and Royal were as they tried to kill each other.
He was still studying the TV.
So answer me this, Ziggy. How do you know to go there?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You scrambled off the plane. All of Dover was on lockdown. With all the hell that was breaking loose, even if you had called for help.
I get it.
There was no time. You had to make a split-second decision. But even so, don't bullshit me, Ziggy. How do you know Nola and Royal were in that old warehouse?
Zig looked up from the hospital gown he was still clutching like a miniature world, but he didn't say a word.
She told you, didn't she? Master Gunn said. It wasn't a question. Nola texted you for help. She reached out and told you she was in that warehouse.
Zig studied his friend, knowing that tone in his voice. He seemed pretty confident in his assessment.
You went through that burner phone I was carrying, didn't you?
Sig asked.
Now Master Guns was the silent one. This is my job, Ziggy. And truthfully, I'm not even that surprised she texted you to come running. But what I still can't figure out is why. Even on her best day, Nolan never asks for help, not from anyone. So when I look at a situation like this, I just need to know. Was she simply panicking in a moment of desperation? Or did you actually manage to ingratiate yourself enough that she somehow, by some miracle, put a tiny bit of genuine faith in you?
Zig went to say something, then decided against it.
I can live with either.
Master Guns nodded, finally turning away from the TV.
Tossing his hospital gown aside, Zig hopped off the bed and headed for the door. Back to the mortuary. Back to work.
Ziggy, can I say one final thing?
I thought that final thing was the final thing.
About Dino's body. For the embalming. I understand why you want to work on him.
It's a little weird and Adams family-ish, but I get it. Closure's good. Master Guns took another breath, his voice softer than before. After that, though, maybe it's time for a break.
What kind of break?
A break. A real break. Enough with so much death. Every day you're around it, surrounded by it. Maybe you... I don't know. Are you firing me? I'm not your boss, Ziggy. I'm your friend. Then say what you're saying. Master Guns stood there a moment, shoulders straight, chest out, unreadable. 2 days ago, when we were trying to figure out this Blue Book stuff, we started wading through all the real details about Harry Houdini's life. Is this another magic story? It's a death story, your favorite topic. Anyway, during the research, I found out that before Houdini died, and this is true, he gave secret passwords to those closest to him, to his wife, to his brothers, even to those in his little corps, Clifford Eddy, Rose Mackenberg, and Amadeo Vaca. Each got an individual code, a word known only to them. That way, if the person died and there was a seance, Houdini would know if the so-called ghost that the medium said had appeared was the real deal or not. So the ghost would say the magic word to the medium, and then Houdini would know he wasn't being scammed? I know. The guy was more obsessed with corpses than you are. But as we kept digging, we also found that Houdini gave one of these passwords to his mom. She was the ghost he wanted to speak to most of all. Apparently, he never got over her death. When she passed, it was such a devastating loss, it tore him apart for the rest of his life, Master Guns said, glancing over at Zig. Now Zig was the one looking up at the blank TV. Here's what caught my eye, though, Ziggy. You know what his mom's secret password was? After all the death in Houdini's life, after spending so much time obsessing over it and chasing fake mediums and going after spiritualists and spending part of every show proving that every fortune teller was a sham, you know what code word he gave to the one woman he wished he could have back more than anyone else? It was a single word. Forgive. Zig turned from the blank TV. Forgive? Listen to the man. It's good advice. I thought we were chatting about my job. About me taking a break. We are. Then make your point, Zig insisted. You're not dead. Zig laughed. Thanks for the sagacious advice. I'm serious, Ziggy. You're not underground. There's no dirt on your face. You've spent so many years around these lifeless corpses, thinking they're the ones you're helping, but it's time for you to come back to life. I am alive. Not just alive, Ziggy. It's time to live again. It's the one trick Houdini could never pull off. But you can. Zig thought about that. My point is, Master Guns took another breath through his nose. Maybe when this is over and you've finished working on Dino's body, maybe you step away from Dover for a bit. Maybe go to a plain old regular funeral home and just work on some civilians. Old ladies, 90-year-old men whose hearts finally gave way. People who were missed, but who don't have you up to your eyebrows every day in a full-fledged tragedy. You know that's not my, or better yet, hit the road. Forget Delaware. Go be a pirate again. Travel around. See the country. For the average funeral home, when there's a hard case, they usually recommend a closed casket. But with your sculpting skills, what you can do for people, for their families, that's a dying art. Go be a pirate again, and share it. Forgive. Live. It'll do you good. My life's here, Zig said, though what he was really thinking was a far simpler truth.
a truth he wasn't about to share.
What other life do I have?
Master Guns stared at his friend, then took off his glasses, polished them on his shirt, and slid them back on his face. His eyes never left Zig.
Don't look at me like that.
You know I can't just leave this place, Zig said.
Ziggy, everyone has an arrow in their life. For all these years, you followed that arrow. But maybe it's time to follow a new one.
You practiced that arrow metaphor, didn't you? No way did you just make that up on the spot.
Your jokes don't work on me, Ziggy. Maybe it's time for a new challenge.
I like working with the troops, with our fallen. I like helping them. I'm not leaving.
You do what you want, Ziggy. But just think about it, okay? That's all I ask.
Zig nodded, like he appreciated the advice. But as he headed for the door, he already knew his answer.
I'm not leaving, Zig called out, turning the corner and stepping into the hospital hallway. He meant it.
91. 3 days later.
I assume someone's coming to pick you up? Nurse Angela asked.
They're on their way, Nola said. It was a lie. Hospital rules said that for liability purposes, Nurse Angela had to roll Nola's wheelchair down to discharge and stay by her side until her ride arrived.
I just spoke to them, Nola explained.
Nurse Angela nodded, pushing and not really caring. 10 minutes later, they were waiting in the hospital lobby, Nola still in the wheelchair, her leg extended in the Frankenstein brace they gave her to keep it immobile after surgery. Behind her, Nurse Angela stood there, staring outside at the few double-parked cars, baby clouds rising from their tailpipes as they waited for their loved ones.
Miss Nola, you sure they're on their way? Nurse Angela asked.
Absolutely, any minute.
Nola liked Nurse Angela, liked the way she called her Miss Nola, and always had a chewed pen in her breast pocket. Anxious. Real worry for her patients, but also impatient. By Nola's calculation, it wouldn't be long before Nurse Angela got antsy and excused herself. Forget hospital rules. Angela still had another 8 patients to deal with. Once she was gone, Nola could call a cab and get the hell out of here. Truth was, she could call one right now, but she didn't want anyone in the hospital knowing her personal details.
Miss Nola, if it's okay with you...
There she is,
a man's voice announced. Nola turned, just as the sliding doors parted ways. Zig walked in, big smile on his face as he headed toward her.
Sorry I'm late. Someone's pinball machine bounced out of a pickup truck and onto Route 1, so traffic on the highway was biblical,
Zig said, shaking the nurse's hand, holding it extra long to turn on the charm. Nurse Angela stared at Zig's face, at the stitches and his black eyes and bruises. His left hand was in a cast.
You were here a few days ago. Zig. Some call me Ziggy.
Nurse Angela didn't answer.
You know this person? Of course I know her. I'm her ride, Zig said. I'm talking to her,
Nurse Angela shot back, turning to Nola and pulling her own hand from Zig's grip.
Yeah, Nola said from the wheelchair. I know him.
You want me to...
He's harmless, Nola said. Plus I can hit him with these, she added, raising the metal crutches that were wedged alongside her in the wheelchair.
Nurse Angela stood there a moment, trying to decide if she believed her. She didn't, but she didn't have much choice.
On behalf of Kent General and all the liability insurance that goes with it, you're officially discharged. Miss Nola, you have a nice afternoon. I've got patients to see. Like Mr. Robbins, who keeps complaining of the smell even though he's the one farting up his room.
Zig and Nola watched the nurse disappear up the hallway, neither of them saying a word until she stepped inside an elevator and the doors slammed shut.
Why are you here? Nola asked.
You need a ride, right?
Zig dangled his keys.
I own a car.
Nola looked up from her wheelchair and saw the grin in Zig's eyes. The way he was biting the inside of his cheek. Excited. Hopeful.
I'll take a cab, she said.
To Washington, D.C.? You're going home, right? You know what a cab will cost from here? At least 300, maybe 400 bucks. You think you can afford that right now? I'm a free ride. Don't be such a mule.
She shot him a look, her pointy features hitting him like a spear.
Fine, be a mule. But don't be so stubborn that you make a decision you'll regret in 2 minutes. Come on. You don't even have to talk to me.
Nola didn't like Zig. She understood him more, but she still didn't like him. My bag's behind the...
I see it. I got it,
Zig said, grabbing the shopping bag that hung off the push bar of the wheelchair. It was filled with clothes, meds, and post-surgery instructions.
Watch your feet,
Zig added, steering the wheelchair out the front door to an old 2011 Honda Odyssey. A minivan?
Borrowed it from work. Figured it'd have more legroom for you.
Dover has minivans?
Most mortuaries do. When you're moving caskets, the seats go down and back and...
I got it, Nola said. Outside in the cold, she noticed an Asian woman with a weak chin, a doctor on her cell phone, pacing back and forth. The doctor had cracked, dried lips, which she kept licking. No lip balm. Unprepared. Or lazy. Or maybe just strong. As they reached the passenger side of the van, Zig went to help Nola out of the wheelchair. She waved him off, maneuvering the crutches into place and hopping up on one foot. She opened the door herself, sliding into the front passenger seat. Inside, the minivan smelled lemony fresh. No dust. The dashboard all shine. Better than most in the military, but that's how everything was at Dover. Still, Nola noticed that one of the knobs was missing from the radio. The front windshield had a small chip from where a rock hit it, and down by her left hip, there was a stray thread in the stitching of her leather seat.
You buckled in?
She nodded. Neither of them said another word as they headed past the mom-and-pop shops that dotted Main Street, half the red brick storefronts looking new and refurbished, the other half dwindling and marked with four lease signs, as if the town itself still hadn't decided if it was living or dying. Nola stayed silent as Zig turned left onto 301 South, the landscape widening out and looking like every other four-lane commercial byway in America, all the mom-and-pops replaced by Walgreens and Pizza Huts. Within a few miles, the landscape expanded yet again, the storefronts now gone. On either side of the highway was nothing but acres upon acres of farmland, for as far as the eye could see, all of it dusted with patches of snow.
Those are wheat and barley fields,
Zig said, pointing to a wide swath of land on their right.
You'd think the frost would be bad, but it's actually warm under the snow. Helps the smaller grains thrive.
Nola lowered her visor to block the orange sun that teetered in the late afternoon sky as it waited to set in the distance. As the shadow hit her face, her leg was in pain. She shifted in her seat, but didn't say a word.
I'm sorry you got fired,
Zig said after a moment. Nola turned toward him, trying to decide if she was surprised the news traveled so fast. So far, the White House had been able to keep it out of the papers, and apparently was still working with local law enforcement to avoid prosecution. But after all that Nola had done, sneaking back onto her old base, attacking Marcus and dragging him onto that boat, plus pulling the trigger on both Houdini and Royal, self-defense. That's what Nola's military-appointed lawyer called it. The White House didn't argue. They'd never admit it, but the president's team was probably thankful Royal and Houdini were gone. With them dead, cleanup would be that much easier. Operation Blue Book would get a new name, everyone who worked there would stay protected, and their good work could continue. Life moves on. Nola knew the truth, though. She knew it days ago. Even if the White House was happy, this was still the military. Doesn't matter if you save the day. Once you kick the chain of command, there had to be consequences.
I saw they named a new artist in residence, Zig added. That must have been a tough job to say goodbye to.
Nola didn't answer.
After all you did, though, I'm surprised they only gave you a general discharge.
Under honorable conditions, she clarified. He nodded.
You can apply for a recharacterization in 6 months. I bet they'll change it. They bust balls, but you'll get your honorable discharge.
Nola stared straight ahead, the shadow from the car's visor making it look like she was wearing a blindfold.
Nola, if it makes you feel better, I told them how helpful you...
Why are you here, Mr. Zigarowski? Are you looking for a thank you? Is that why you made the trip?
Zig didn't even turn at the question. He knew it was coming. Tapping his thumbs on the steering wheel, Zig let out a sigh. His voice was soft, softer than she'd ever heard it.
Master Guns told me you were healing just fine, but I guess I wanted to see for myself. Wanted to make sure you were okay. See what you were doing next.
And that's it?
That's it.
The car hit a small bump, a divot in the road, sending a flashbulb of sunlight into Nola's eyes and another shockwave of pain through her leg. She glanced over at Zig. The orange sun lit him up, revealing all the lines in his face. Smile lines, frown lines, and so many worry lines.
Painting, she blurted.
Pardon?
They fired me. You asked what I was doing next. Painting. I'll keep painting.
Like for a gallery?
She hit him with the kind of look that 26-year-olds give to 50-year-olds.
Don't be a schmuck. The army made me their artist in residence for a reason. I like seeing the world. I figure I'll take my pastels, travel around, see what I can find.
So kick up some trouble?
Nola shot him another look, rolling her eyes. She then reached for the glove compartment. Inside, she found a pad and an old Cracker Barrel pen. She rested the pad on her good leg and began sketching.
I was thinking of starting in New Orleans. Never been there.
You'll love it,
Zig said, watching her pen scratch at the page.
What about you, Mr. Zigarowski? You staying at Dover?
He nodded.
This is where my life is. Plus all the fallen soldiers. I like the job. Lets me help people.
Ahead of them, the road veered to the right, past the longest wheat and barley field they'd seen thus far. Zig, thinking that when the winter was done, this whole field would be replanted with soybeans. Same dirt, just depends what you put in it.
Nola, in your art, in all the canvases I saw at your office, why were you always painting attempted suicides?
Why do you spend so much time around the dead, Mr. Zigarowski?
I told you, I like helping people.
So,
why suicides?
Nola was still sketching, working the outer edges of whatever she was drawing. Looked like a snake. Or a lake. Something long.
I don't know. There are lots of kinds of deaths. Suicides just interest me.
It does more than interest you. It's in every painting.
What are you getting at, Mr. Zigarowski?
I want to know if suicide...
He thought about when they were back at the motel, about the scars on her wrist.
Is it something you've thought about yourself?
Nola said nothing. Her body went still and her hand stopped moving. She didn't look up from her sketch.
Not for a while.
For the next mile or so, the road continued to veer right, at one point intersecting with a narrow street called Strawberry Lane that held only an enormous steel lattice transmission tower.
Nola, during your time in the military, you ever meet a man named Dr. Robert Sadoff?
Zig finally asked. Nola sensed a lecture.
Sadoff works in my field, spends a lot of time around death,
Zig added.
I saw him speak at a conference years ago. They call him the father of modern forensic psychiatry. When there's a murder in the military, or anywhere, really, they would bring in Dr. Sadoff to testify. He'd use forensic science and medical details about the human mind, then tell the court whether the suspect had the mental competence to commit such a crime.
So he says whether people are crazy or not?
That's his job. The real point is Dr. Sadoff is a man of science. His decisions hinged on medical facts. But when I saw him speak, he insisted he was also a man of deep religious faith. Loved God, said his prayers. And when someone asked about his faith, Sadoff traced it back to when he was 5 years old in his hometown of Minneapolis.
One morning, a fire engine was flying toward an emergency when its driver missed a turn, sending the truck straight at the local drugstore that was owned by Sadoff's father. The fire truck slammed headfirst into the prescription counter where Sadoff's dad worked every day. But on that day, Zig explained, Sadoff's dad had stepped out of work for a few hours to say religious prayers for a relative who had just passed away. For the rest of Dr. Sadoff's life, this man of science pointed to this moment as absolute proof that the universe has a divine plan.
Nola stared down at her sketchpad, thinking about it for nearly 30 seconds. Not for me, she finally offered.
Me either,
Zig agreed, both of them smiling, then to their own surprise, laughing. Actually laughing. On Nola's notepad, with another few lines, the picture slowly bloomed into view. It was a drawing of her extended leg, wrapped in its elastic ace bandage and protected by the bionic-looking knee brace with its hinges and adhesive straps. From Nola's point of view, her wound. You know, I knew her, Nola blurted. Zig glanced over, confused. Maggie, she said, the words hitting like a bomb. Your daughter. Zig's head tilted almost imperceptibly.
I thought, back at the funeral home, you said...
We weren't friends. Never even sat near each other. But it was seventh grade. I knew who she was. Everyone knew who she was. I saw her every day.
Zig sat there, staring straight ahead, trying so hard to listen. But Nola could see the way he was clutching the steering wheel like it was a life preserver.
I can't say she was ever really nice to me, Nola added. I don't think we ever said two words to each other. But one day at the end of gym class, everyone was playing Do It and You're Cool.
Do It and You're...
It's a game. Seventh grade. Someone dares you to do something, then everyone chants, Do It and You're Cool, Do It and You're Cool, until you...
I get it.
Think Truth or Dare, but with less truth. And more assholiness. Regardless, on this day, a girl named Sabrina Samuelson...
I remember Sabrina. She was in Girl Scouts.
I remember her, too. Nasty little shit goblin who always wore a French braid and rhinestone keds. On that day, Sabrina was leading the charge, demanding that I show everyone the tampon that she somehow spotted in my backpack. It was a trap, of course. If I took the tampon out, the entire seventh grade would know about my menstrual cycle. If I denied having one, they'd crucify me for being behind the curve, Nola explained. But there was Goblin Sabrina riling up the crowd.
Do it and you're cool. Do it and you're cool, Nola chanted. Oh my God, she's about to cry.
Nola recounted the tease with perfect clarity. Her voice returned to normal. That wasn't true. The only thing I was about to do was take the combination lock I was holding and smash it into Sabrina's face.
I'm sorry they did that to you.
Stop apologizing. Just listen. The crowd was in a lather now.
Do it and you're cool! Do it and you're cool!
And before I realized what was happening, your daughter Maggie appeared from nowhere. She was on her own mission, racing up to Sabrina, grabbing her by the arm and telling her,
Lucas just asked out Charlotte M.
In a fit of teenage giggling, Maggie and Goblin Sabrina went running, the crowd of prepubescent sheep now following them to a brand new childhood nightmare.
Why are you telling me this?
Zig asked. When they were leaving, Sabrina and Maggie, the two of them were leading the pack, running down the hallway from the central locker area, cackling like seventh grade bitches. But just as they turned the corner and disappeared, Maggie glanced back over her shoulder. I saw it right there, Mr. Zigarowski, on her face, in her anxious green eyes. Even back then, I knew real concern when I saw it. When she pulled Sabrina away, Maggie knew what she was doing.
So you became friends?
Maggie never said another word to me. Not once. Not even after my ear got burned at the campfire. And I'm not saying she was some saint. She was too well aware of her own popularity for that. But on that particular day when the crowd and the pitchforks were pointing my way, your daughter... Nola paused, searching for the right phrase. She couldn't find it. You raised your daughter right. Zig was worried his voice would give him away. So he just nodded. He smiled.
He clutched the steering wheel, amazed he was actually holding it together. That lasted a full 3 seconds. Zig's chin quivered first, then his lips. Then the full emotional earthquake hit, sending shockwaves through his body, rippling upward as they climbed his face and squeezed the tears out from behind his eyes. Nola wasn't surprised. He's a father. He missed his daughter. And he did. He missed Maggie every day. But for Zig, these weren't tears that came from a loss. They were tears that accompanied a return. For 14 years, Zig had grown accustomed to Maggie being gone, grown accustomed to having her birthday marked by quiet or having the day she died be equally ignored. It was the most profound pain that death delivered, the utter numbness that comes from when you can't get over it but somehow get used to it. For 14 years, Zig knew the contours of Maggie's death, the rules of it, the limits. And then with a single 2-minute story about vengeful seventh graders, Zig had what he never thought he'd have again. New details of her life. And just like that, his daughter, his little star, was alive again. He had a new memory of her, something he never thought he'd ever get. He was smiling now, and crying, doing both of them together as tears of joy pushed out from behind his eyes.
Nola,
he said, turning to her. You're welcome, she said, her eyes down, focused on her sketch pad. And I'll consider us even if you don't hug me when we get to D.C. Zig laughed, knowing she meant it.
Can I just... What you said about Maggie...
Just enjoy the ride, Mr. Zigarowski. Can we just do that?
But what you said... I just need to know. That night at the campfire...
Enjoy the ride, she insisted, pointing the tip of her pen toward the front windshield. Outside, the road stretched out in front of them, the orange sun so low it turned the entire sky tangerine. Breathtaking, Zig and Nola thought simultaneously. Nola memorized the color for a future painting. Next to her in the driver's seat, Zig hit the gas, still replaying Nola's words in his head. Enjoy the ride. And for the first time in a long time, in maybe 14 years, he did.
92. 2 weeks later. Balancing a six-pack of beer on his hip, Zig fumbled with his keys, fighting to turn the lock on his front door. With a click, the door opened. He wiped his feet, the mat perfectly in place. Heading for the kitchen, he pulled 2 receipts from his left pocket, one from lunch, one from Donnie's Liquors, plus a folded-up business card from the peppy new woman who was just hired in Veteran Affairs. Every month brought new faces to Dover. Few people could handle it for too long. He threw it all in the trash. Next to the toaster, his daughter's red hairband was gone. These days, he was wearing it around his wrist. You have no messages, the robotic answering machine announced as Zig hit the button in the kitchen. Just like the night before. And the night before that. 2 minutes later, Zig was in his backyard, ritual beer in hand. How's everyone tonight, ladies? The bees sang as Zig opened the roof of the hive and added some food. A homemade sugar and water mixture he called bee cupcakes. As he slid into his favorite rusty lawn chair, Zig threw his coat aside. The weather had turned over the last few nights. It was still 55 degrees, but after the recent cold spell, Zig was determined to make the most of the respite. By the way, I met the new candy guy today, Zig told the hive, which was buzzing with life, swarming the landing board. Bee cupcakes always kicked off a dance party. Twix are out. New M&Ms with caramel are in. Can you imagine? No Twix? Blasphemy, Zig said. I mean, how do you even explain poor decision-making like that? The bees hummed. I agree. Cultural bias. Like the SAT, Zig said, taking a swig of beer, then licking a bit of excess from his lips. For the next 20 minutes, Zig sat there in his lawn chair,
nursing his drink and enjoying the private concert of the bee's low-pitched mmm. A crescent moon lit the sky. The cool air felt nice. It was a near-perfect night. On his far left, past the barbecue, a single stray honeybee swirled in the air, making wobbly loop-de-loops and bouncing a few times off the wooden fence. Guard bee? No. This bee was bigger, longer. A forager, the ones who get to leave the hive, since they always come back. Sig watched the bee do another shaky loop-de-loop, ramming itself yet again into the fence, like it was drunk or trying to escape. In reality, it was just old. Foragers were the elders, dying in huge numbers every season. But that didn't slow them down. In the next few months, with the arrival of the first blooms, full foraging would begin, thousands of bees flying up to 4 miles to get nectar and pollen to nourish their hive. Foragers were stubborn, too, Zig thinking about how many times he'd come home and find a bee so weighed down with pollen and nectar, they'd be twisting in the grass, struggling to get back to the hive. Wonderful creatures, committed to their mission. Still, after decades of intense study, there was one question about foragers that scientists couldn't answer. Where do they die? Every single day, foragers go out and come back home. Out and home. Out and home. But for some reason, 99% of deaths happened away from the hive. That's not just luck. That's a trait, an instinct, a natural law. For years, like most scientists, Zig assumed it was a way to protect the hive, keeping it free from sickness and disease. Or maybe it was Darwinism. The weaker foragers would go out, but didn't have enough strength to make their return. Yet tonight, as Zig sat there in his lawn chair, watching this stubborn, lonely bee make yet another fruitless loop-de-loop, he couldn't help but think that maybe, deep in the bee's psyche, it knew what was coming. It knew the end was near. So when it left for that final flight, instead of yet another mission for the hive, maybe, just maybe, it would go off on one final adventure. Or who knows, maybe more than one. With a final swig of beer, Zig pulled out his phone. His thumb hovered past Facebook, tapped on a browser, and quickly navigated to one of those online travel sites with a purposely weird name that you could never remember. Flights. One way. Destination. Zig sat there a moment, wondering if he was being impulsive. Then a new thought hit his brain. The words of the amazing Caesar, who told him there were only 4 different magic tricks. You make something appear. You make something disappear. You make 2 things change place. Or, the one Zig liked most, you change one thing into something else. Zig stared down at the red hair tie on his wrist. It'd be fun to pirate again. Go around, see the world, and of course, do some good. So, where to start? New Orleans, he typed into the search box. He'd heard it was nice this time of year. There are many kinds of death, Zig thought to himself, but there are also many ways to live. It's one of the few things they never teach you at mortician school. Sometimes you need to bury your old life and make a new one.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Escape Artist, written by Brad Meltzer. Read by Scott Brick and January Lavoie. Produced by Christine M. Farrell. Recorded at Audio Media Production and Brick by Brick Audiobooks. Post-production by James Bennett. The Escape Artist is also available in print and digital formats from Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by 44 Steps Incorporated. Audio production copyright 2018 Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.